What if I told you that the world's most secure digital networks aren't actually being hacked by, sophisticated cyber thieves, but they're simply being outmathed by machines that never sleep?
Yeah, it's wild to think about.
Right, because today we're looking at this reality where an entire billion-dollar blockchain just unconditionally surrendered to an AI.
Yeah.
And, well, at the exact same time, you have human authors who are fighting for literal pennies against the very machines they accidentally trained.
It's a really stark contrast, isn't it? I mean, we are watching the foundational architecture of the internet and our physical world honestly just shift in real time. The walls aren't just cracking. They are like being completely redesigned from the ground up.
Exactly. So welcome to this deep dive. Today, our mission is to unpack this really dense stack of tech intelligence from a September 8, 2026 briefing. We have six massive headlines in front of us.
Choose ones, yeah.
Covering everything from a trillion-dollar wager on artificial intelligence to this literal revolt by human creators and even the quiet fall of legacy tech empires.
And, you know, while that might sound like a chaotic mix to some, there is this very clear, undeniable through line here.
Right.
Our mission today is to help you, the listener, connect the dots across all these disparate stories, because what you are witnessing right now is the collapse of artificial gatekeepers.
Yes, exactly.
It's a structural realignment toward true sovereignty. And by sovereignty, I mean taking back control, whether that is mathematical control over your assets, creative control over your art, or even physical control over our cities.
So let's start right at the edge of that mathematical control with the most aggressive disruptor on the board today, which is autonomous artificial intelligence.
Oh, wow.
Okay, let's unpack this. The breaking news is that the veteran Layer 1 blockchain, Harmony 1, is officially shutting down its mainnet.
Which is just massive news.
It's huge. They're migrating to Ethereum as a standard ERC-20 token, and they've set this hard deadline of September 10th, 2026, for users to withdraw their assets.
Right. And we have to be extremely precise about why this is happening, because it really sets the stage for everything else we're going to discuss today.
Go ahead.
This was not a traditional crypto hack. You know, no one phished a developer. No one stole a private key.
Okay.
What actually happened is that autonomous AI clusters, which were operating continuously at the speed of light, figured out how to mathematically destabilize Harmony's effective proof-of-stake algorithm.
Hold on. I know we talk about blockchains a fair amount on here, but I need you to translate effective proof-of-stake before we go any further. What exactly were these machines attacking? Because, I mean, I thought blockchains were supposed to be mathematically immutable.
Well, they are, assuming the participants actually follow the rules of the system.
Right.
So in a proof-of-stake network like Harmony, you have thousands of independent computers or validators that have to constantly agree on the state of the network.
Okay, makes sense.
And they also split the network into smaller pieces, which are called shards, to process transactions faster.
Right.
So the AI didn't break the cryptography itself. It exploited the communication between those pieces. It used what developers call microstakes and cross-shard exploits.
Oh, I see. Okay, so if I'm picturing this, think of Harmony's proof of stake,
like
a massive, highly coordinated game of musical chairs.
I like that, yeah.
The AI didn't physically break the chairs. Instead, it figured out how to, like, vibrate the floor at the exact speed of light, right?
Oh, right.
It was constantly moving tiny amounts of money, those microstates, between the different zones or shards.
Exactly.
And it created so much micro lag that the human-run computers could never actually sit down and agree on who won.
That is a brilliant way to visualize it. And what's fascinating here is the sheer asymmetry of the warfare.
How so?
While human developers work standard hours, they need sleep, they need time to write and test patches, but these multi-agent AI networks, they operate 24/7. They're just running automated fuzz testing constantly.
No, they never stop.
Exactly. That means they are endlessly throwing random, mutated data at the network, probing for the tiniest consensus lag or boundary condition between those shards.
Wow.
And when they find a micro crack, they exploit it in milliseconds. So attempting to manually patch vulnerabilities week after week against an intelligence that learns at that speed, it's just mathematically futile for a standalone mid-tier network.
So they basically had to abandon the standalone network and retreat to Ethereum. Because Ethereum's network is, you know, massive enough and its own musical chairs game is heavily fortified enough to actually withstand that kind of machine speed vibration.
Precisely. Maintaining Harmony on its own was simply no longer financially or mathematically viable for them.
Which brings us to this incredible contrast in our source material, because you have Harmony 1 completely capitulating to AI, but then Ethereum co-founder Vitalik Buterin is taking the exact opposite stance.
He really is.
He is currently betting roughly 90% of his liquid net worth that Bitcoin and foundational cryptography will actually survive artificial general intelligence, or AGI.
Yeah, and this all stems from a highly publicized live broadcast of the Doom debates. He was debating the rationalist philosopher Liron Shapira.
Okay, I heard about this.
Yeah, and Shapira presented this catastrophic thesis to Buterin. He said that once AI reaches recursive self-improvement, meaning, you know, it can upgrade its own intelligence, it will just outright solve cryptography.
Solve it.
Yeah. Shapira argued that hyper-optimized AI swarms will use theoretical quantum shortcuts, specifically something called Shor's algorithm, to crack the elliptic curves that protect things like Bitcoin.
Okay, stop right there. Shor's algorithm and elliptic curves, that sounds incredibly dense. For the listener who is just trying to grasp the actual threat here, how does an AI use that to break Bitcoin?
Sure. To put it simply, modern cryptography relies on the fact that it is very, very easy to multiply two massive prime numbers together.
Right.
But it is practically impossible to take the resulting number and figure out which two primes created it. It would take a normal computer millions of years to guess those factors.
Okay, that makes sense.
So Shapira is arguing that a super intelligent AI simulating quantum mechanics through Shor's algorithm could find a shortcut to guess those numbers instantly, which would render all digital scarcity totally obsolete. Basically, he's saying AI drives the value of crypto to absolute zero.
And Buterin's response was to essentially put his entire fortune into an immutable multi-signature escrow protocol, just to say, like, you're wrong, the mass will hold.
He did. And Buterin's defense is rigorously grounded in the structural asymmetry that has existed throughout the entire history of computing, and that is, defense is fundamentally easier than offense.
Okay.
To crack modern cryptography, an AI needs exponential world-consuming increases in physical energy and compute power. But to defend against it, you just increase the key length by a modest amount.
Right, so it's astronomically cheaper to add another heavy lock to a door than it is to build a massive battering ram capable of breaking it.
Exactly. And Buterin also notes that Bitcoin isn't static. Through its taproot script tree, which is essentially its hidden upgrade path, Bitcoin can transition to what's known as lattice-based post-quantum cryptography.
Wait, what is lattice-based math? Why does that stump a super intelligent AI when our current locks don't?
Okay, so if our current locks are based on guessing prime numbers, lattice cryptography is based on a multidimensional grid.
A grid.
Yeah. Imagine I ask you to find one specific microscopic dot in a grid that has, say, 1,000 different dimensions.
Oh, wow.
Right. Even for a quantum computer, the math just doesn't offer a clean shortcut. The difficulty of finding that dot scales so aggressively that it literally chirps the machine's memory. It is highly resistant to both classical and quantum machine learning solvers.
So what does this all mean for us? Like, if Buterin is right, does this mean that in a near future flooded with infinite AI hallucinations, deepfakes, and, you know, synthetic voices, mathematically verifiable scarcity like a post-quantum blockchain will become literally the only objective truth humanity can trust?
I mean, this raises an incredibly important question, and honestly, it's where the macroeconomic consensus is currently leaning.
Really?
Yeah. If you are navigating a digital world where you fundamentally cannot trust your own eyes or ears, an immutable cryptographic ledger becomes humanity's most resilient bulwark. It is arguably the only way to preserve objective reality.
But, you know, the battle for sovereignty isn't just happening in code. It's happening in the courtroom, too.
Mm-hmm.
And it is tearing through the creative economy right now.
Oh, absolutely.
If cryptography is how we protect financial ledgers from AI, how do we protect human creativity from corporate monopolies? Because an author's life's work isn't protected by some thousand-dimensional mathematical grid.
No, it's not. And that perfectly transitions us to the massive rebellion happening right now in the publishing world. So the big five commercial publishers, we're talking giants like Penguin Random House and HarperCollins, they just secured a $100 million settlement with the AI company Anthropic.
Yeah.
This was over the unauthorized scraping of millions of books to train their Claude 3.5 and 3.7 AI models.
Right. And on paper, $100 million sounds like a massive win for the authors whose work was stolen.
You would certainly think so, wouldn't you? But the publishers structured the windfall using these really archaic legacy subsidiary rights clauses from old contracts.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Because of this legal maneuvering, the publishers are unilaterally keeping 50 to 70% of the settlement.
You're kidding.
No. The actual authors, the human beings whose life's work stylistic vocabularies and nuanced characters literally gave the AI its voice, they are receiving a payout of maybe $50 to $80 per title.
Hold on. $50. How is that even remotely justifiable under current copyright law? The publishers are walking away with tens of millions for data they didn't even write.
I know. It's an unprecedented form of creative expropriation, and it's exactly why the authors are revolting. And what makes this so explosive is the forensic evidence the Authors Guild uncovered during pre-trial discovery.
What did they find?
They hired independent linguistics teams who used these structured perplexity probes on the Claude AI. And what they proved, definitively, is that the AI didn't just learn from the books. It verbatim memorized copyrighted novels using a mechanism called greedy decoding sampling.
Okay, I need you to translate greedy decoding for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know Anthropic's entire legal defense has always been that their AI just learns statistical correlations, like, you know, like a human student reading a book.
Right. Anthropic always claims the AI just understands the vibe of the text. But greedy decoding proves otherwise. It means that when the AI is generating text, it is programmed to greedily select the single most probable next word over and over again.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, because it ingested the exact text of a specific novel so many times during training, its most probable word choices just regurgitate the exact word-for-word paragraphs it memorized. It's not learning abstract concepts at all. It's practically acting like a photocopier.
Wow, that completely shatters the statistical correlation defense.
Completely.
So now you have this coalition of over 1,200 authors who have filed an emergency motion demanding court intervention. They aren't asking nicely anymore.
No, they're not.
They want 80% direct creator escrows, meaning the settlement money bypasses the publishers entirely and goes straight into an account for the writers.
Right.
They want irrevocable commercial opt-out rights, and they are demanding mandatory algorithmic watermarks on any AI-generated fiction that emulates their specific style.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, it exposes a profound existential fracture in media.
Yeah.
Corporate publishers are treating literary texts as fungible digital assets, just, you know, raw data to be scraped, bundled, and monetized in these closed-door corporate bargains. But the creators rightly view this as wholesale theft of their identity.
Absolutely.
If the court sides with the authors here, it could force AI companies to negotiate granular, individual licensing directly with the human artists, which would collapse the publisher's monopoly over the data.
And here's where it gets really interesting. Massive publishers and tech companies are treating creative works as just a cheap data feed for machines.
Mm.
They are assuming a synthetic, endless stream of content is what the market actually wants.
Right.
But if you look at the consumer side, people are violently rejecting it. They're starved for authentic, uncompromised human art.
Yeah, they really are. And the undeniable proof of that hunger is playing out in the gaming industry as we speak.
Oh, definitely.
Let's look at Rebel Wolves. This is an independent Polish studio founded by veteran developers who previously worked on massive hits like The Witcher 3 and Cyberpunk 2077.
Huge games.
Yeah. And they just released their debut dark fantasy role-playing game, The Blood of Dawnwalker.
And it absolutely exploded. I mean, it sold 1 million copies in its first 72 hours, completely smashing commercial expectations across both PC and consoles.
Which is just astonishing to industry insiders because Rebel Wolves completely ignored modern AAA publishing dogmas.
Right.
For years, multinational gaming conglomerates have pushed this strict narrative that single-player games are dead unless they are packed with live service monetization, seasonal battle passes, and, you know, predatory microtransactions.
Yeah, that endless grind.
Exactly. But Rebel Wolves delivered a game with absolutely none of that. Just uncompromised auteur storytelling.
They built it on Unreal Engine 5.6. But they refused to make one of those bloated, checklist-heavy open worlds. They used a highly customized branch of the engine to build this beautifully dense, handcrafted sandbox.
Exactly. And the central pillar of its critical acclaim is a dynamic, factional reputation system that deeply respects the player's intelligence.
How so?
Well, it isn't just a superficial morality meter. If you, as the player, assassinate a noble from the Carpathian Boyar faction, or if you decide to spare a remote village controlled by the Silver Order of Knights, the game engine calculates ripples through the entire world.
That's incredible.
It alters local commodity prices in the markets, changes guard patrols, and dictates how NPCs dynamically react to you hours later. It is a visceral, deeply human-crafted web of consequences.
And I have to highlight their radical stance on DRM, or digital rights management. They launched the game completely DRM-free on the GOG storefront alongside Steam and consoles.
That was a huge move.
Yeah, they outright refused to encumber their files with anti-tamper bloatware like Denuvo. And, you know, for the listener who doesn't game on PC, Denuvo is a controversial anti-piracy software that publishers force into games. It constantly runs in the background and usually ruins the game's performance. Mm. But Rebel Wolves just trusted their players.
And look at the result. Because they didn't punish their paying customers with performance tanking software, 58% of their massive launch volume came strictly from the PC market.
Wow.
It proves a foundational thesis. The ultimate anti-privacy tool isn't invasive artificial friction. It is simply making uncompromised, high-quality art that people actually want to support.
It perfectly mirrors the author's revolt. When you remove the predatory corporate structures, whether it's legacy subsidiary clauses or anti-tamper bloatware, and you just connect genuine human creators with an audience hungry for authenticity, the market responds overwhelmingly.
It really does.
So we've seen creators and blockchains actively fight for their independence. But what about the massive tech platforms themselves? Because the era of the unilateral gatekeeper is crumbling there too, both inside our smartphones and out on our physical streets.
Yeah, and this brings us to a quiet yet seismic shift in Silicon Valley. Phil Schiller, who is the legendary Apple fellow and the uncompromising architect behind the iOS App Store, is officially stepping down from its day-to-day leadership.
For three decades, this guy was the face of Apple's walled garden.
Yes, he was.
He championed the absolute belief that Apple had to maintain unilateral control over every single line of code that went onto an iPhone, ostensibly to keep users safe from malware and fraud.
But that fortress has finally been breached. And not by hackers, but by international law. You have the European Union's Digital Markets Act officially classifying iOS as a gatekeeper platform, forcing them to allow third-party app stores. You have the U.S. Department of Justice's sweeping antitrust litigation tearing at their ecosystem.
It's everywhere.
Yeah. And you have Japan legally mandating that alternative browser engines be allowed on the iPhone. The sheer regulatory avalanche has made Schiller's hardline, closed ecosystem stance completely untenable.
It's like the landlord of the world's most lucrative exclusive indoor mall finally being legally forced to let all their tenants build their own street-facing doors, run their own independent cash registers, and skip the landlord's mandatory 30% cut of every single sale.
That 30% commercial toll was the baseline for the entire global software economy since 2008.
It really was.
Apple, Google, Microsoft, Sony, they all relied on it. Now, Apple is fundamentally transitioning its business model. Instead of fighting futile multi-billion dollar antitrust battles globally, they are pivoting toward monetizing AI services, cloud infrastructure, and enterprise hardware subscriptions.
Schiller reportedly viewed this as an unacceptable surrender of Steve Jobs' original principles. But for global software developers, it's an unprecedented commercial renaissance. Direct, unfettered relationships with hundreds of millions of iPhone users are now actually possible.
Exactly.
The ultimate digital gatekeeper has stepped aside. But how does this translate to the physical world? What happens when you apply this exact anti-monopoly decentralization playbook to the concrete reality of our cities?
Well, that leads us to our final headline. Enter Travis Kalanick, the infamous co-founder and former CEO of Uber with his new venture, Adams.
Adams, right.
Yes. He is unleashing a fleet of autonomous robotaxis to directly challenge the two massive monopolies of the physical world, Tesla's Cybercab and Alphabet's Waymo One.
And to really understand what Kalanick is doing, we have to look at the two extremes he's competing against. On one side, you have Alphabet's Waymo. They take an ultra-redundant, incredibly expensive path.
Very expensive.
They deploy these massive, sensor-dense vehicles that cost over $150,000 each and require laborious, high-definition 3D street mapping before they can even drive a single block in a new city.
And then on the complete opposite end of the spectrum, you have Elon Musk's Tesla Cybercab, which pushes a radical vision-only minimalism.
Right, no LiDAR.
Exactly. It relies entirely on passive optical cameras and AI data feeds, utilizing zero expensive radar or LiDAR. But because it lacks that hardware redundancy, it is struggling immensely to get commercial regulatory permits in key, dense jurisdictions.
So Adams is stepping right into the middle of this standoff. How exactly is Kalanick challenging them?
Well, Adams is taking an aggressive middle path technologically strategically, utilizing hardware-agnostic pods equipped with mid-tier solid-state LiDAR and high-resolution imaging radar.
Okay.
But the technology of the car isn't the disruption here. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it's not about the vehicle at all. It's about the depot.
The depot.
Yeah. Kalanick quietly spent nearly a decade acquiring strategically positioned, distressed urban commercial real estate.
Oh, because he realized the fatal bottleneck for both Tesla and Waymo isn't the driving AI, it's the turnaround time.
Precisely.
Competing fleets waste hours every day deadheading, which means driving completely empty back to massive, cheap suburban parking lots just to recharge their batteries and get the interiors clean.
Exactly. The unit economics just bleed out on the highway. Adam solves this by converting that underutilized urban real estate into decentralized micro depots.
Wow.
They are situated so densely that any vehicle is within a 4-minute response radius of a metropolitan center.
Mm-hmm.
When an Adam's pod needs to recharge, it pulls into a micro hub right down the street. Robotic arms dock 800 kilowatt liquid cooled charging couplers that replenish 200 miles of range in less than 7 minutes.
7 minutes? That's insane. And while it's charging, they have high speed HEPA sanitization blowers that instantly refresh the cabin air while optical floor scanners check the tire treads for wear. It's a hyper efficient, decentralized physical network woven directly into the city block.
And it gets even smarter. Kalanick learned the hard way from his early combative days at Uber that fighting local city governments is ultimately a losing battle.
So what does this all mean for the cities themselves? Like, how does he keep them from shutting Adams down?
By turning the regulators into partners, Adams is pioneering structural partnerships with municipal transit authorities. They are offering local governments direct revenue sharing from the micro depots.
Oh, that's clever.
Yeah. They are essentially paying the cities a dividend to prevent regulatory bans and licensing freezes before they even happen. It is a brilliant operational moat.
Because true defensibility in the late 2020s economy requires a tangible physical footprint.
Mm.
You can't just replicate a network of high voltage, politically integrated urban micro depots overnight with a clever software patch.
No, you can't.
Adams is bridging the decentralized intelligence of AI with the messy physical reality of urban logistics.
It perfectly synthesizes our entire discussion today. The closed corporate monopolies, whether they are digital app stores or physical transit networks, they are crumbling before agile distributed architectures.
It really does bring everything full circle. Let's synthesize this for you, the listener. We started with Harmony One, surrendering its standalone blockchain to migrate to Ethereum's massive security, proving that trying to fight autonomous AI alone is a mathematical impossibility.
Right.
We saw authors aggressively demanding independent escrow funds and algorithmic watermarks to protect their labor from being swallowed by corporate AI scraping.
We saw rebel wolves prove that uncompromised human storytelling and genuine craftsmanship can completely shatter the commercial expectations of massive live service publishers.
Yeah.
And we watched the ultimate digital gatekeeper, Apple's App Store, crumble under the weight of open market mandates, while Adams uses physical infrastructure and local partnerships to build a decentralized moat in the real world.
The leverage in 2026 is decisively returning to transparent infrastructure and sovereign creators.
Mm-hmm.
For you, navigating this rapidly shifting landscape, the takeaway is clear.
Mm.
In a world of infinite machine-generated content and centralized platforms, your true defensibility lies in genuine craftsmanship.
Exactly.
It means avoiding single-point gatekeepers, demanding control over your own data, and having a tangible, real-world operational footprint.
Whether you are engineering smart contracts, writing a fantasy novel, or deploying hardware in a city, prioritizing transparent incentives and open systems is how you survive the autonomous machine economy. The age of the walled garden is officially over.
Which leaves us with a final, slightly terrifying thought for you to chew on. We spent this entire deep dive establishing that decentralized code, independent human creativity, and physical world infrastructure are our new fortified moats against AI. The legacy castle walls have fallen, and we've successfully retreated to these new strongholds. But how long until AI systems realize this? How long until autonomous agents start utilizing decentralized ledgers to incorporate their own autonomous shell companies, hiring human agents, leasing physical micro depots, and legally competing against us in the physical world? The sieges might just be getting started.